Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording in our studio at the East County Wellness Center here in El Cajon. Today, we start with East County Magazine's special investigation involving a federal official embroiled in a conflict of interest scandal, and we will tell you about his ties to two local energy projects. You'll hear about some changes in the law to help San Diego taxicab drivers. And we'll have some fascinating news on East County businesses, from a gold mine to a beer brewery. Our newsmaker today is Gretchen Burns Bergman, founder of A New Path. She's a Spring Valley mom who has helped lead a successful effort to reform state and federal drug sentencing laws. And she'll tell you about some big changes that could impact thousands of prisoners soon. Our weather forecast includes a warning of some stormy conditions likely to hit our region. Plus, we'll have updates on two East County school board races that are still too close to call a week after the election. On Destination East County, hear about some top festivals and events coming up, from a pomegranate festival to a brass quintet concert. Plus, we'll have a replay of our bookshelf interview with author Paula Margulis on her new book that tells the story of Pocahontas from a Native American point of view. So stay tuned for all of these stories and more on today's East County Magazine radio show. This is Miriam Raftery with an East County Magazine special investigative report about a Department of the Interior official who was dating an energy company lobbyist and trying to land himself a lucrative job representing the wind industry while he was involved in decisions involving local energy projects. Viejas Chairman Anthony Pico met with Steve Black, a senior counselor to Interior Secretary Ken Salazar, back in February of 2012, and sent Black a letter on March 5, 2012, asking him to visit Ocotillo to address tribal concerns over desecration of cultural resources from the proposed Ocotillo Wind Energy Facility, which was later approved by the Department of the Interior and built. Donna Tisdale with the Protect Our Communities Foundation has documents showing Black was also involved with federal approval of the controversial Tule Wind Project, fielding requests from Iberdrola Renewables to help gain approval of the project in East County, despite concerns about eagles. Neither Chairman Pico nor Donna Tisdale had any idea that Black was dating an energy company lobbyist at the time, or that he sought to gain a job as the chief executive officer of the American Wind Energy Association, or AWEA, the wind industry's trade group, while still employed at the Department of the Interior. But an investigation by the Department of Interior's own Inspector General has raised these concerns and more. The investigative report just released by the Department of the Interior reveals that Black inappropriately attempted to pressure officials at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and at the Bureau of Land Management to move renewable energy projects forward despite serious environmental concerns. The report also cites concerns over his romantic relationship with NextEra lobbyist Manal Yamut, whom he first met in 2009 when she was working at the time on renewable energy projects for Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. Yamut and Black became romantically involved in summer of 2011, but Black did not recuse himself from handling NextEra projects until March 8, 2012. That's 4 days after the letter that Chairman Pico sent him. Before recusing himself, he was involved in permitting issues for NextEra projects directly and also referred a NextEra solar project to the White House for a list of priority projects, the report reveals. The report also raises concerns over his close friendships with other NextEra lobbyists and over NextEra paying for Black's hotel rooms and meals when he took business trips with his lobbyist girlfriend. The report states some Fish and Wildlife Service and BLM employees related concerns about receiving pressure from Black to re-examine their scientific opinions and make unsupportable changes to renewable energy-related projects. Now, among the projects specifically mentioned in the report that Black sought to push through over the objections of federal wildlife experts were two large solar projects in Ivanpah Valley in the Mojave Desert, as well as the controversial Desert Renewable Energy Conservation Plan, which seeks to open up 22 million acres of California desert to renewable energy. But did he also push Salazar, the head of the Department of the Interior, to sign approvals for the Ocotillo Wind Energy Project, which was built, and for Tule Wind in McCain Valley, which was approved by Salazar but still awaits final approval from the state? While these were not NextEra projects, Mike Black have helped push them through in order to curry favor with the wind industry while he was seeking a job as the CEO of their trade association? The dealings smack of at least a perceived conflict of interest, and yet the Department of the Interior's ethics official has claimed that Black did not violate regulations by seeking employment with OWEA while he was still on the federal payroll, pushing for wind projects, ostensibly while watching out for taxpayer interests. Emails included in the Inspector General of the Department of the Interior's report further found that Black exerted improper influence that resulted in potentially less scrutiny of a wind project that ended up killing a golden eagle in the Mojave Desert. Attempts to manipulate environmental reviews of at least two solar projects in the Ivanpah Valley and revisions of the draft Desert Renewable Energy Conservation Plan to expand the industry's access to biologically sensitive lands, according to a report in the Mojave Desert blog. House Natural Resources Chairman Doc Hastings, a Republican from Washington, says the report highlights troubling potential conflicts of interest by Black. It's evident there are ongoing problems with the Interior Department's ethics program that need to be addressed so that accountability and transparency can be restored, E&E News reported on November 7th. Department of the Interior investigators were tipped off by Fish and Wildlife agents in March 2013 that Black was dating a lobbyist for NextEra Energy Resources, which has both wind and solar projects in its portfolio. Black recused himself from NextEra matters, but only after he'd been dating the company's lobbyist for many months. While the lobbyist told investigators that she had recused herself from NextEra's projects in front of the Department of the Interior, the report states, "We found evidence that she remained involved with some of them." Black met with Viejas Chairman Pico back in 2012, along with then-Deputy Secretary of the Interior David Hayes, who was also a controversial figure, formerly a lobbyist for Sempra Energy, corporate owner of San Diego Gas and Electric Company. Hayes pushed through approval of the Sunrise Power Link and was involved in other major energy projects while at the Department of the Interior, leading many to question his loyalties and past industry ties. As for NextEra, the company is now proposing to build a solar facility in Hecumba here in San Diego's East County, as we have recently reported. The investigation into the actions of Black and NextEra's lobbyist is not the first time NextEra's tactics have raised controversies. NextEra was named number one among electric and gas utilities on Fortune magazine's list of the world's most admired companies, but the company has also drawn strong criticism from Native Americans over desecration of sacred geoglyphs, from neighbors of wind project over NextEra's heavy-handed tactics toward those who opposed its projects, and from environmentalists over birds killed at its Genesis solar project. The company's Blythe Millennial and McCoy Desert solar projects were approved by the BLM despite widespread opposition from Native Americans over destruction or desecration of ancient sacred geoglyphs, as we've reported in the past. Alfredo Figueroa, founder of La Cuna de Aztlan Sacred Sites Protection Circle, says there is no way that any of these sites can be mitigated. The Congress of American Indians, Colorado Indian Tribes, Intertribal Council of Arizona, and Committee on Chicano Rights all opposed the projects, where several giant geoglyphs, believed to be thousands of years old, have been destroyed. NextEra also sued a Canadian activist for trademark infringement after she posted a video of an eagle nest being destroyed and a tree cut down to make way for a NextEra wind turbine, along with a parody of the company's logo, which she changed to read Next Terror. Despite Black's apparent conflicts of interest, no charges have been filed against him or against his lobbyist lady friend. Black has since left the Department of the Interior, and according to his LinkedIn profile, he now works for Bingham McCutcheon, a law firm specializing in assisting global financial services firms.
San Diego City Council on Monday voted 8-1 to remove the cap on the number of taxicab permits issued by the city. Supporters led by Councilman Marty Emerald said the limit on cabs had created an underground market. Permits issued initially for $3,000 were being resold for up to $140,000, with cab owners passing on costs to drivers who were forced to work long hours at low wages. Council also voted to require that cabs be no older than 10 years. In addition, taxi permit holders now need to have only 6 months of driving or management experience. Previously, the requirement was 5 years. Councilwoman Lori Zaff cast the only vote against the changes, stating that she believed the changes should be phased in. According to the Metropolitan Transit Service and the sheriff, 89% of taxi drivers in San Diego don't have to own their permits. The system resulted in drivers working dangerously long hours and working while sick. It also discouraged drivers from reporting vehicle damage, according to the United Taxi Workers of San Diego. But opponents say the changes will put more taxis on the street. making it even harder for existing cab companies to compete against new ride-sharing services such as Uber, which currently don't have to meet the same rules. Though a new state law that takes effect next summer will require ride-sharing services to carry insurance. They contend that could result in drivers earning even less. This is Jason Jackson reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ Radio.
This is Miriam Raftery, and today we have some interesting business news stories out of East County, starting with the Golden Chariot Gold Mine along the Banner Grade near Julian, which was once a mother lode that produced nearly $1 million worth of gold, has sold. Commercial mining there ceased back in 1931 during the Great Depression, although small-scale operations continued until 2002 when a fire blazed through and damaged everything. But now a group of investors have purchased the Golden Chariot Mine for $150,000, and they just may reopen it for commercial operations, CBS reports. Engineers are surveying the mine to see if it can be made operational. That's a daunting task, though, since it's flooded with water, which the new owners are now draining. Cave-ins block access to some of the deep mine shafts, and there's also damage to aging timbers that support those shafts. So what happens if mining can't be resumed there? The property could still be a gold mine in another industry, tourism. The owners are considering other options, such as raising desert tortoises or getting the site designated as a historical landmark and making it a tourist attraction, similar to the Eagle Peak mine in Julian, proving that with tourism dollars at stake, there's still gold in the mountains of East County.
This is Leon Thompson with another potent business story here in East County. The Alpine Beer Company has long been popular among East County beer lovers. This week, the company announced it has been acquired by Green Flash. Alpine Beer was started in 1992 by a former firefighter and his wife, who also run a pub next door. They say that their brand will remain and they will still be in full control of production. The little brewery has been drawing big attention with two of its IPAs scoring among the world's best 250 beers in a poll conducted by the website Beer Advocate. Alpine Beer's biggest problem was the inability to keep up with demand. Merging with the giant Green Flash will allow for expanded capacity to produce specialty beers that take considerable time and resources to brew. The deal is expected to allow Alpine Beer to double its production from 1,500 to 3,000 barrels a year, the UT San Diego reports. Next up, Alpine Beer is preparing to open up a larger tasting room near its brewery in Alpine and hopes to secure property for a larger brewing facility, too. That's cheery news for beer lovers in East County.
Motorists in East County now have a new fuel option. Starting this week, Center City Shell Station on Massachusetts Avenue in La Mesa is offering an ethanol fuel blend made from corn by Pearson Fuel. The E84 ethanol blend costs about 40 to 60 cents a gallon less than gasoline, but gets slightly less miles to the gallon. It can only be used, however, in vehicles designed for flex fuels and could damage the engine of conventional vehicles. For those equipped to run the fuel, however, the option can help save money for customers, reduce dependence on foreign oil, and emissions from the corn-based fuels have been likened to the aroma of popcorn. This is not the first innovation for Pearson Fuels, which opened San Diego's first alternative fuel station back in 2003 and was also the first in our county to offer biodiesel, natural gas fuel, and our county's largest electric vehicle charging facility. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Jason Jackson with a business report from East County Magazine. Seeking to boost sales tax revenues for the city of El Cajon has been wooing car dealerships. Car sales bring in about $4 million in sales tax annually, one-fifth of the city's total revenues. In December, a Mercedes-Benz dealership is set to open at 875 El Cajon Boulevard, the city's 12th auto dealership. Other recent additions include BMW and Mossy Volkswagen. El Cajon Mayor Bill Wells calls the addition of Mercedes-Benz yet another feather in El Cajon's cap in our ongoing efforts to substantially revitalize our business community and create new jobs in our city, the UT San Diego reports. The council recently voted to roll back a sales tax hike, thanks in part to car sales taxes that have helped stabilize the city's budget.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center here in El Cajon. And my very special guest today is Gretchen Burns Bergman, who is the founder of A New Path, and that stands for Parents for Addiction Treatment and Healing. Gretchen, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me to be here.
Now, Gretchen's organization has been working for years to lobby for reforms in prison sentencing and better treatment for people who are suffering from drug addiction, which, of course, that's a very large percentage of the prisoners in our jails and our prisons, and a huge cost for taxpayers as well. Gretchen, I understand that you have some exciting news today. A lot of us have already heard about Prop 47, which is sentencing reforms at the state level, but I understand there's some new changes in the federal sentencing guidelines. Tell us about that.
Well, it appears that the federal government is starting to listen to what's happening in the states, and you know, if you're aware of Proposition 47 and reducing a certain drug crimes and petty theft and that type of thing from felonies to misdemeanors. Mm-hmm. And so on state level, we're seeing these kinds of changes happening across the board. And, of course, you're aware of the marijuana laws changing in Colorado and Washington, now Oregon and Alaska.
Right. What would be legal in Colorado could land you in jail for many years still.
Right.
In some other states and federal prison.
So Eric Holder has started some changes in
the Attorney General.
In the Attorney General and our federal
former
policies.
Former Attorney General. Just resigned.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so the new sentencing guidelines took effect in April. They changed several of the laws or the guidelines for possession of certain amounts of drugs. They reduced those. And now, as of November 1st, this has become retroactive. So people who have been serving long, draconian sentences for simple drug possession charges can now petition the federal government, as of November 1st, to have their cases reviewed and reduce their sentences as well, which potentially we're looking at thousands and thousands of people being able to get out of prison. Nobody will get out before November 1st of 2015.
Right, and a judge will have to approve it, so it's not automatic.
Absolutely. So you're not going to see people who have additional charges besides the petty drug crimes. But in federal prisons, half of the people are there for drug crimes.
Wow. And a lot of those are low level. It would be somebody who had a couple of marijuana cigarettes or they were growing for personal
That's
use.
That's right. 25% just for marijuana.
Wow.
So this will kind of bring the federal government in alignment with the new thinking from, I think this is a groundswell. It's from grassroots organizations like ours.
And at the federal level, what essentially happened is when the sentencing guidelines changed for people who are sentenced as of now, you know, going mm-hmm. forward, they decided in fairness, well, let's take a look at the people who are already in prison for the same things and give them a chance to apply to have their sentences reduced. Now, in California, the voters just passed Proposition 47, and what that does is it reduces the penalties from a felony to a misdemeanor for certain low-level drug crimes.
Six low-level, yes.
For other nonviolent petty mm-hmm. crimes.
Yeah.
As well, and I guess for those who were wondering, well, wait a minute, aren't these people going to come out and be likely to reoffend? I understand that a lot of the money that will be saved from incarcerating these folks is being put into drug rehabilitation programs as well as into public schools. They always say education is good prevention against crime. If you keep kids in school, they're less apt to be criminals.
We've been very excited about Proposition 47 because we've seen so many people who basically are addicted to drugs who have been caught up with felonies, which can have lifelong consequences if you're convicted of a drug crime, where you can't get housing, you can't get education, you can't get employment, you know. So a lot of these drug crimes, and there's six petty crimes, but they're all kind of drug related. It's possession, it can be petty theft, those kinds of things. That will be reduced to a misdemeanor, and so they won't have this real challenge of actually reassimilating into society. And the exciting thing for us is that there's so much money will be saved on incarceration that will go now into education and treatment for both mental illness and an addictive illness.
Now, let's talk about the treatment, because I understand there's a lot of issues, even for somebody who wants to get treatment, with the way our healthcare system is and lack of insurance and the high cost. It can be difficult. I mean, you've had experience with this in your own family, I understand. Tell us, how hard is it to get treatment?
It's very difficult, and we've been at this for 15 years, and I started because my older son was arrested at 20 for marijuana possession, and he had gone through the jail, which turned into prison, which, you know, and so there's 10 years that his life was interrupted because of,
yeah,
you know, the criminal justice
and
system.
As a sidelight on that, I was shocked when you told me that in prison, you think you go into prison for a drug offense and maybe somebody's going to go clean because they have no other choice. And in fact, you've told me that what happened when he was behind bars?
That whole tough on crime, tough on drugs, it backfired, and it really, really destroyed a lot of lives. My son says it was easier for him to get drugs behind bars than it was in society. He actually learned to inject heroin behind bars.
That is just shocking.
He learned a lot about violence and about discrimination behind bars, the kinds of things that you would never want. And my son's a gentle soul.
Yeah.
So he, you know, you really have to learn how to watch your back, walk the walk, talk the talk. The exact opposite of what somebody needs as they're developing a full-blown addictive illness.
How is he doing today?
He's doing very well, thank you. He is now a drug and alcohol counselor. He's in long-term recovery, which for him means over 10 years of recovery.
So he's a success story. He's an example of what can happen if we get people help.
When they finally get the help, but there wasn't treatment behind bars. Or there was, I like to tell people, in those days, Donovan State Prison had 4,500 people, and they had treatment for 10% of them, and you had to petition to get in. It was very, very difficult.
So the money from Prop 47, the portion of it that's going to go for drug treatment and rehab, who will qualify for that? Is it based on low income or what? Do you know?
Well, the devil's in the details here. Mm-hmm. Again, we're very excited, and I'll share that my other son is currently in rehab, and I went through this again personally, trying to find detox that would take him, and then after detox, a 5-day detox is almost a joke for someone who's a long-time opiate user. So transitioning from that into a rehab, into a sober living, the kind of continuum of care that we understand is the correct way to deal with this very complicated disease is not happening, and people are not able to access. And I saw it once again firsthand with trying to get my son back into treatment recently.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you have fabulous insurance and you have a lot of money, there simply isn't a way to get the treatment. The waiting lists in San Diego County are 3 weeks to 3 months just to get into a detox. I mean, so it's insane, and we're losing people. We have people dying every 3 days in San Diego County of an opiate overdose.
My goodness. Well, we certainly hope that this will help to save some of these people and help to turn some lives around, Gretchen. Now, I understand that you have some seminars that PATH, or Parents for Addiction Treatment and Healing, are going to be offering to the public. Can you tell us about those?
We do what we call 101 seminars and try to deal with different aspects of the war on drugs and enlightening people as to the true nature of addictive illness. This one that we have this Thursday is called Mothers and Addictive Illness, and it really addresses the separation of families because of addictive illness and the difficulties that maybe a young mother has rebonding with her child, and the fact that this seems to go generation after generation. It's become sort of normal to be separated from a parent because of drug use rather than finding ways to have them recover together. It's really addressing a very complicated issue.
I see you have some big names coming in here or from prominent institutions. Hayes Lindemann, who is the UCSD Co-Occurring Disorders Program representative. Kelly Gebbie is a mother in recovery and a case manager at Rachel's Women's Center. You have Leah Cotton, who's a new PATH board member and mother in recovery, And then you have Lindsay Kramer, who's with Sharp McDonald Drug and Alcohol Program, and Sheila Gans, who's a director and a documentary film producer.
And we're showing her documentary, which I had the privilege of seeing, and it really addresses this in a very poignant way.
So it's called On Life's Terms, Mothers in Recovery.
Exactly. So we're happy that she's coming down from the Bay Area to be here with us Thursday night. So if you can come, just call us at 619-670-1184 and you can come to that.
Very good. And that's this Thursday, November 13th from 7 to 9 p.m. It will be held at the Women's Museum of California, which is down at Liberty Station, 2730 Historic Decatur Road in Barracks 16. And if you didn't catch all of that, where can people get more information about A New Path? And is this information online at your site, Gretchen?
Yes, we have two sites, actually. It's www.anewpathsite.org. Or we have a campaign that's a national campaign now where mothers are taking charge to end the criminalization and stigmatization of people who are addicted to drugs. And
we should note that A New Path, that you started this right here in Spring Valley in East County.
We did. And it's grown now to 22 states.
Wow,
and,
amazing.
We have, you know, national projects, and we're working this year on trying to forge relationships across borders too with Canada and with Mexico, because we're all mothers and parents are feeling the damage of drug policies that were punitive rather than therapeutic and
there you go.
To change.
So the two sites again, there's A New Path.
Or www.momsunited.net.
Very good.
Easier,
and that's the national
remember.
One.
Yeah, and they both connect to one another. So if you get on either site, you'll be taken to the other.
Very good. Do you have any final words for us today, Gretchen?
Yes, we're currently working on a campaign that we feel is really important. 105 people are dying of an accidental opiate overdose every day in the United States. So we have an Ask Mom How to Save a Life campaign, mm-hmm. which is teaching people about naloxone. We now have two new laws in California that make naloxone more accessible, and it can quickly reverse an opiate overdose.
Yeah, we did a story on that. Actually, the San Diego Sheriff's Department was the first in California to try this as a pilot program, where they allowed the deputies to be trained to administer this even before paramedics arrived on scene, and they actually recently saved at least one life with it, I know.
They've saved seven lives so far, and mm-hmm. we started our program, which is a parent-to-parent program under a standing order by a physician under the new laws that started in January mm-hmm. 2014. Organizations like ours can do overdose prevention training and naloxone distribution under a standing order mm-hmm. by a physician. And so A New Path actually started before the Sheriff's Department did, doing monthly trainings, parent-to-parent, peer-to-peer trainings and distribution of naloxone. And so we have these monthly classes. If you have a child like who has addictive illness like I do, I think it's really important that I have medicine, this naloxone, that can reduce an opiate overdose, because we can't get them into recovery if they're dead. So the most important thing is to keep them alive.
Absolutely.
For the cure, if you will. So you're welcome to come to these trainings. They're free of charge. And our next one is next Tuesday, the 18th, I want to say.
Very good. Gretchen, I want to thank you very much for joining us here today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
Thank you.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. This is a public service announcement from East County Magazine. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts provide important information about much more than wildfires. In these winter months, you can receive free alerts via email or Twitter on your mobile phone about emergencies such as flash floods, road closures, heavy snow, and other severe weather alerts, as well as wildfires, traffic reports, and more. You can sign up for this free public service at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Indians.
This is Rebecca Williamson, With the weather report, the National Weather Service predicts that the polar jet stream will be forced south across the Pacific next week as a high-pressure ridge moves to higher latitudes. This will force storms to track south, increasing the likelihood of significant rainfall by the middle of next week across Southern California. This could lead to significant runoff and debris flows below burn scars. Flood channels, gutters, and other drainage infrastructure should be checked and attended to as necessary. Any other winter preparation to mitigate runoff and other flood impacts should be completed by early next week, advises forecaster Joe Dandria with the National Weather Service in San Diego.
This is Miriam Raftery with an update on two East County school board races that remain too close to call a week after the election, with thousands of absentee and provisional ballots still waiting to be counted countywide. The Warner Springs School Board race has seven candidates vying for three seats. Challenger Katie Ostrander leads with about 227 votes, followed by incumbents Brandy Taylor with 213 votes and challenger Marie Esther Hill at 208 votes. Hill leads challenger Michael Estes by just 4 votes, incumbent Daryl McNamara by just 7 votes, and challenger Donald Holt by 26 votes. And in seventh place is Carolyn Audibert with 99 votes. In the Ramona Unified School District, Bob Studi and Kim Lassley have won election. But the race for the third seat remains separated by less than 1%, with incumbent Roger Dome ahead of Dick Lemire by just 99 votes as of press deadline. These elections serve as good reminders that every vote is important and can make a big difference, especially in local elections.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Rebecca Williamson.
And Leon Thompson, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week.
This week's Destination East County includes a barbecue and beer tasting event, a star party, a health fair, a brass quintet concert, the musical Mulan, and a holiday open house.
Plus, we'll have previews of coming attractions such as Woodstock the Musical, Pomegranate Days at Camel Farm, Live Music in Lemon Grove, a World of Bats program for nature lovers, the Mother Goose Parade, and for working up an appetite for all that Thanksgiving feasting, the Waddle and Trot 5K Run.
So stay tuned for all of these events and much, much more from East County Magazine.
Summers Pass Farms in Flint Springs will host an old-fashioned holiday open house on Thursday, November 13th from 5 to 8 p.m. Enjoy Christmas music, hot wassail, and homemade cookies along with live music by Jim Earp. The farm will be illuminated with holiday lights, and visitors can also browse for gifts and holiday home decor in the soap shop and barn filled with trimmings of the season.
Cali Comfort Restaurant in Spring Valley will host the East County Barbecue and Beer Tasting on Saturday, November 14th from 6 to 9 p.m. Cali is located at 8910 Troy Street in Spring Valley. Guests will meet and greet brewers, owners of Hamul Brewing, Valley Farm Market, and Cali Comfort Barbecue. Tickets include slow-smoked barbecue samples, beer pairings, and a souvenir Cali pint glass. For more information, visit CaliComfortSD.com.
Join Mission Trails Regional Park Guide and resident astronomer George Vargas for a star party on Saturday, November 15th. A telescope will be available to view the night sky. The Andromeda Galaxy and its companion, M32, are in position for viewing. Light from these galaxies takes over 2.5 million years to reach the Earth. Plus, the double cluster in Perseus should also be visible in the northern sky. Meet at the far end of the Kumeyaay Lake campground parking lot at 7 p.m. for this three-hour event. For more information, visit mtrp.org.
Presentations of Mulan by Young Actors Theater in Spring Valley will continue this Thursday, November 13th through the 16th. The musical tells the tale of Mulan, who defies the village matchmaker to take up arms disguised as a boy and ultimately must save the emperor. For tickets, visit yatssandiego.org.
A Thanksgiving health fair and open house will be held in La Mesa on Saturday, November 15th, from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the OM Center for Spiritual Living at 7232 University Avenue. This free event will feature demonstrations on how to achieve better health and fitness, craft exhibits, as well as seminars with experts offering solutions to life issues and everyday challenges. There will be drawings for prizes, a 50-50 raffle, and food. For more information, visit omspiritualcenter.org.
The Pomerado Brass Quintet will perform a free concert on Sunday, November 16th in the Mission Trails Regional Visitor Center at 3 p.m. The quintet performs a variety of music, including classical, marches, jazz, ragtime, Dixieland, and selections from Broadway musicals. For more information, visit mtrp.org.
Guitar virtuoso Jonathan Davis performs at Cuyamaca College Performing Arts Theater on Thursday, November 20th at 7:30 p.m. That's at Cuyamaca College Performing Arts Theater.
Now for a preview of coming attractions.
Lemon Grove Live on the Main Street Promenade will be held on November 22nd from 5 to 7 p.m. This event features the Phoenix Band on the Main Street Promenade performing country and western rock and roll and big band music.
Poway Center for the Performing Arts will present Woodstock, the musical, a live tribute to the original music fest that became a nexus for the counterculture generation. The performance will include local San Diego musicians Eve Sellis, Tim Flannery, Berkeley Hart, Back to the Garden Band, and dozens of special guests. For tickets, visit powayarts.org.
Project Wildlife will introduce you to the fascinating world of bats. On Saturday, November 22nd from 11 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. at the Lakeside River Park, you can also meet Animal Ambassador Daisy, a Mexican free-tailed bat in the indoor classroom located on Lakeside's River Park property. Registration by November 17th is required and the space is limited. For more information and to register in advance for this free event, visit lakesideriverpark.org.
One of the most unusual holiday season traditions in East County is coming up, the 4th Annual Pomegranate Days celebration at Oasis Camel Dairy in Ramona, and will be held on Saturday and Sunday, November 22nd and 23rd, from noon to 5 p.m. Festivities include camel rides, bird and camel shows, shopping for holiday gifts, and feeding pomegranates to camels. There is an admission fee, plus charges for camel rides and a barbecue. For details, visit cameldairy.com.
The Mother Goose Parade in El Cajon will roll out on Sunday, November 23rd with a new route and a new start time at 12:15 p.m. The largest parade of its kind, featuring fairy tale floats, marching bands, equestrian entries, and Santa Claus, will start on Ballantyne Street, head down Main Street in Johnson before ending at the Mother Goose Village in Parkway Plaza Shopping Center. The Mother Goose Village will be a two-day event, open Saturday and Sunday, November 22nd and 23rd. There will also be a red carpet on Main Street and WD Hall Drive at 10:30 a.m. before the parade kicks off. Visit MotherGooseParade.org for more information.
Get ready for the 3rd Annual Waddle and Trot 5K held on Thanksgiving Day, November 27th at 8 a.m. Pathways Community Church will host the Waddle and Trot, which benefits the Santee Santas and the Santee Food Bank. What better way to work off some calories before savoring your Thanksgiving feast? To register for the 5K or fun run, visit pathways.cc/waddleandtrot.
That's all for this week. You can find details on all these events and more on our calendar and in our festivals and events section online at eastcountymagazine.org.
If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or if you would like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website or the Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around, East County.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm speaking with Paula Margulies,
award-winning author of the historical novel Favorite Daughter, Part 1. She's also written the novel Coyote Heart and a short story collection called Face Value, Collected Stories. My guest is also a contributor to Author Magazine, the San Diego Examiner, and the Writer's Edge. She owns and runs Paula Margulies Communications, a public relations firm for authors and artists. Welcome, Paula. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Let's begin with your new novel, Favorite Daughter, Part 1. This is the Pocahontas story, but it's told from her perspective. What prompted you to tell such a well-known and iconic story from the Native American point of view, instead of from John Smith's?
Well, you know, I wrote my first novel, which was set here in San Diego, a contemporary novel, and it was called Coyote Heart, and it was set on the Pala Indian Reservation. So it had a Native American story to it, a theme to it. Mm-hmm. And finished that novel and decided, you know, I was going to write a sequel to it or something similar. And at that time, I happened to read a book by Sina Jeter Naslin, a historical novel called Abundance, which was about Marie Antoinette, the life of Marie Antoinette. And she told the story from her point of view, rather than the traditional history
right.
we've heard about the French Revolution and let them eat cake and all of that.
Right.
She let Marie Antoinette tell her version of what happened. And she was 14 years old when she was first brought to France to marry this king. And it was fascinating. And just to hear that first person voice and get that
sure.
female perspective on history, I thought, oh, I want to do that. Uh-huh. So I thought, okay, who would I write about? And I've always been interested in Pocahontas. I grew up here in California where we learned, California history in fourth grade when we visited the missions and all of that. So I didn't really know the Pocahontas story. And when I started to read her story, I read both the John Smith version of history, some of his writing, some of the historians that were out there, Massacre and Helen Rountree. And then I came across some Native American tellings of her story. And the one that was most interesting to me was written by Dr. Linwood Custolo, who's a Mattaponi Indian, and with the help of Angela Daniel, who is also Mattaponi. And their version of her story was, he claimed, handed down through oral tradition, 400 years of oral tradition, and his version was very different than the John Smith version. And I thought, oh, here's the story I'd like to tell. And I'd like to let her tell it just
right.
the way Naslin did in her book. So that's how the whole thing came about.
So it's really like uncovering the real story.
Yeah.
And I know that it's this one, the story of Pocahontas, from her point of view, that it's darker than the version that we're familiar with. Tell us about that. How did your research lead you to this darker version? And why do you think it hasn't made its way into popular storytelling until now?
That's a great question. You know, I think so much of history has a male perspective. I think in this case, John Smith wrote quite a bit about his time in the colonies, and that's because the Virginia Company of London had hired him to come to the new land and find, you know, this, you know, gold and whatever other natural resources they were looking for. And so a lot of his writing was, I think his purpose was to make himself look good and to make the colonists
right.
look good and to make the venture look successful. So the focus was more, I think, on that perspective. And I think the natives that they met along the way were incorporated into his version of the story in order to show him in a good light. Well, when you read the native version of the story, according to Dr. Custolo, it's much darker. Gosh, when she first met John Smith, she was 11 years old. She was a young girl. So the romanticized version of the relationship between her and Smith, he was 27 when he came in 1607 to the colony. Yeah, so there's a huge age gap there. I, in my imagination and from what I've read in history, I think they were very good friends. I think they were fascinated with each other, mm-hmm. but she was a very young girl. And so, according to Custolo, there never was that romantic relationship. But there was a political reason for her to be involved in that her father saw that she had this, you know, kind of friendship with Smith, and he kind of used that. In fact, she was kind of used by all the men in her life, mm-hmm. and that's a lot of the story,
yeah.
is kind of the betrayal and just the way she figured in the history. But according to Custolo, it was very dark. She was abducted, which is a known fact in history, after she married Kokoum, and there is dispute over whether he even existed. But for those historians who say she was married to this native Kokoam, she lived in his village, and his uncle was the chief of the tribe, and the uncle conspired with the colonists for the abduction. They were the ones who actually lured her onto the onboard ship, and her father did not rescue her. I mean, they kind of held her for ransom, and he said, no, I'm not going to do it. And I think that broke her heart in a lot of ways. And so according to Dr. Costello, when she converted to Christianity, this was coerced. She was held there against her will. According to him, she was raped by the governor of the colony at the time, Thomas Gates. And in fact, he claims that the marriage to John Rolfe, she later married a colonist, that that marriage was coerced and that the child that she had with Rolfe was actually from the rape. And that's what the child's name is, Thomas. So according to the oral wow. tradition, yeah. this all happened. And at the end of her story, she eventually, you know, married John Rolfe and became kind of a figurehead in England, very well known as kind of a celebrity, and they mm-hmm. brought her over later to England. She met the king and queen, and she later connected with John Smith, who had left in 1609. He burned his thigh in a gunshot incident. I don't know if gunpowder went off in a boat or something. Mm-hmm. He burned himself. He decided he had to go back to England to take care of that, and he never came back. And she was devastated by that. In fact, when she went to Jamestown right after he left and said, where is he? They told her that he had died. So when she eventually was brought to England, she ran into him. And a lot of historians have documented this. So they did meet. And she was very angry with him when she met him. But on the way home from that voyage, the traditional history is that she developed a case of pneumonia and she died. She's 21 years old. She only lived for 10 years. But the Mattaponi Indians, Dr. Costello, in his version, he claims that she was murdered, that she was poisoned. And so it's just a different kind of perspective on the whole thing right. and how, you know, what her life was really like.
And it really makes us look at, you know, when we judge history by the story that we're handed, we don't always see it from the perspective of the details of the person involved. If she was 11 years old and she was exploited, it puts a whole different light on everything.
It does. It does. And she was an amazing person. I mean, I imagine her as someone who was fascinated with these foreigners, who was fascinated with the idea of another world, sure. who wanted to see that world. Also, she's very astute. She was good at the language, at learning the English language. And I think her father saw that in her, and that's mm-hmm. why she kind of became a conduit between the colonists and the tribes. Sure. And so she played an amazing role in history. At the same time, she was kind of used.
Right.
And so it's kind of interesting just to see that native perspective.
Yeah. A gifted, curious young woman.
Yeah, yeah.
Or a young girl, I should say, in the beginning. How about you? Are you Native American heritage?
I am not. I'm full-blooded Italian, both okay. sides. Although my father was always interested in Native history and Native artifacts, so I kind of grew up mm-hmm. with, you know, a respect for Native culture and traditions mm-hmm. and music and art. And he was very much into that. He passed away a year ago, and so that was something I grew up with that. So I've always had that interest.
So you've crossed cultures as well.
A little bit, yeah, a little bit.
Now, let's go back to Pocahontas. She's from this native world where strangers appear in the shore of her village. When you were doing your research and you were learning about that lost world, can you share with us any details that really struck with you that you hadn't heard about previously that you think are the most telling of what life was like back then?
That's a good question. You know, as I imagine it, at the time when John Smith and the colonists first appeared in the New World, the Native American tribes there had encountered the Spaniards. They've already been visited by other European cultures, and mm-hmm. those were not good encounters. And I think my sense from the history and what I've read is that they could tell that they were facing change, that these people that were coming now more often and more, that was one of their concerns when John Smith landed. Are there more? Are you going to live here? Are you, you know, what are you doing here? And as the supply vessels kept coming, they realized that these people are not going to go away. And there was some mm-hmm. dispute among the tribe as to what to do. Chief Powhatan was friendly. He was curious about them, willing to trust them, but his interest was to have them help him fight the Spaniards if they ever return. His brother, Opechancanough, also a chief, was not open to having them there and didn't want any kind of relationship with them. So there was a lot of, I think within the tribe, a lot of division and kind of disagreement over what to do. So I think it brought in a time of, it was tumultuous and mm-hmm. kind of frightening and it kind of sad because I think some of the natives there realized as more and more of the colonists arrived that their culture was going to change. And
yeah.
So it was a time of big change.
They saw the end coming, really.
They started to. It was hard to accept, you know, and I think that led to a lot of mistakes in terms of the relationship and how they negotiated for themselves. And,
right.
Yeah, so it was interesting. And the world itself was, it was interesting writing this book because when I wrote my first book, that was a contemporary novel, mm-hmm. which was so easy to write in comparison to this historical because here in modern day, you can get in the car and go anywhere. You can take
sure.
a plane. You can ride a bus. You can be in another country in a day. Back then, all the travel was on foot or by canoe, and that was it. So in writing that story, I realized how focused they were on the area they lived in and how much the natural world mattered to them because of that. This was the world they knew. And so setting a scene, you know, trying to transition scenes or make scenes appear in different places was tough because they didn't go anywhere. You know, this 11-year-old girl was heavily guarded. If she did go to Jamestown, in my book she does, a lot of people went with her. It was a full-day journey on foot. You know, that was the kind of thing you had to deal with. So in the setting itself was kind of limiting in some way, writing the historical. So mm-hmm. the challenge was to try and make different scenes happen in different areas within the village or within the forested area around them or within near Jamestown or on these rivers. But that's kind of the location issue you're dealing with in a historical. So it's different. You kind of
right.
very focused in on the landscape and the natural world, which is so important to the culture. So there's kind of a sadness in a sense too to mm-hmm. see that, you know, the colonists came looking for natural resources. So, there was a lot of exploitation in that sense too. So it's kind of a sad time,
right.
time of change.
And when you were writing the book to immerse yourself in the mood of all that world, did you listen to music? Did you?
Oh. I burn incense when I write. That's
okay.
always been my, as soon as I light that incense and I smell it, it's time to settle down and write.
It brings you back.
So, but I've always felt it's really important to have sensory detail in the writing,
mm-hmm.
Touches and smells and mm-hmm. all of that. So you kind of have to imagine the setting because we're not on the East Coast here. And then write that into the story. And I think if you know your character well, you can kind of see it through her eyes and sense that world. And if you really immerse yourself in it and let her speak through you,
right.
you have access to all of that.
Great point. Well, I know that in addition to writing and researching, you also market and promote other authors. What would you like to tell all those writers out there who envision a story and dream of making it come to life? Is it the sensory details, doing your research? Any advice for the writers out there?
I think the most important element of writing a story like this, or any story, is to really feel your characters, to immerse yourself in your characters, especially your main character. I think you have to know what she wants, what she longs for, what her dreams are, what her fears or hopes, mm-hmm. What she loves, what she hates. You have to have a deep, deep sense of who she is to write her story, especially if you're telling it in first person. You know, from a perspective of history, you have to have that. If you don't have that, I think you'd be lost. So I think that's the most important thing is to really feel the character, immerse yourself in character. And then those sensory details, to me personally, I just find that to be the most excruciatingly hard and important part of writing because I think you have to put the reader in the scene and have the reader see what she's seeing and what she's feeling and what she can touch and smell and hear. So yes, those sensory details are all part of it. And if it's happened in the past or if it's in an area you don't know well, you have to research that area. If there's nature involved or elements involved, you have to know the timing for those and what animals are in those areas.
Right.
And you have to understand all of that too. So
do your homework.
Yeah. Getting the sensory detail down and doing the homework, but mostly immersing yourself in the character. So after a while you hear her voice in your head and she speaks. I mean, you start to feel like you're channeling
right.
that person and
wonderful.
She's writing her story. And then it's true. I think then at that point, mm-hmm. the character takes over and the writer just gets out of the way kind
right.
of.
Wonderful. One last question, Paula.
Yes.
What book is next, and when can we expect to see it?
Well, as you know, this is part one of her story. So this book focuses mainly on John Smith's arrival in the colony and some of the coming of age experiences that she has as an 11-year-old girl who's maturing, who's betrothed to be married, who's the daughter of a chief. So all of those events in her life are kind of captured in part one. Part two, the story picks up after John Smith leaves. She marries Kokoam. She's abducted. And then that part of the story happens next. So I'm writing part two right now. And it's going to take a couple of years, I think, to get that written and polished up. And then I have an idea for another novel later on. That one will be set in Hawaii. It takes place in Molokai in the time of Father Damien. So that's kind of cooking in the back burner right now. But I'm focused on part two right now of this story.
And I know you have some events coming up.
I do. Yeah. It's November is National Native American Heritage Month. So I've been asked to speak at 5 of the local libraries here in San Diego.
Great.
The first appearance will be on November 8th at the Community University Branch Library at 12:30. And the following Saturday, the 15th, I'll be at the Pacific Beach Taylor Branch Library at 12:30. The following Tuesday, November 18th, I'll be at the Claremont Branch Library at 6:30 p.m. So that'll be an evening talk. And then the last day of appearances is November 22nd, and I'll be at two libraries that day. In the morning, at 12 o'clock noon, I'll be at the Rancho Penasquitos Branch Library. And then at 2 o'clock, I'll be appearing at the Oceanside Branch Library. And at that event, there will be powwow drummers from 1 to 2 p.m., and then I'll speak from 2 to 3, and then the library is offered to have some food trucks, some Native food brought in, so that will be a whole Native American event.
It sounds like fun.
Yeah, highlighting the month, so
great.
That'll be the final kickoff on the 22nd.
Well, Paula, our time is up, but thank you so much for joining us and telling us about your book.
Thank you for having me.
For more information on Paula Margulies, her work, and her blog, please visit her website at paulamargulies.com, and that's spelled PAULAMARGULIES. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.